Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, the final 2 hours of arguments are beginning now in the Supreme Court's extraordinary three-day hearing on the Obama health reform law. We have two great guests to begin the show today on what has gone down so far. We'll play some highlights, too, and we'll see why it may not be as gloomy for supporters of the law as much of the media has been making it out to be in the last day. In a few minutes, the very progressive New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who filed an amicus brief in the case. With us first, the very influential conservative law professor Richard Epstein, now teaching at NYU and with the Hoover Institution. Professor Epstein, welcome back to WNYC. Thank you for coming on this historic day.
Well, it's very, very great to be here.
Did anyone win the day yesterday, in your opinion, or is it pointless to even speculate?
No, I think it's pretty clear that the conservatives outperformed their expectations. Jeff Toobin may be a bit hysterical when he says that all is lost for his cause, but it certainly was a situation in which expectations were confounded. And let me explain why. Going into this situation, if you looked at the lower courts, two eminent judges, Lawrence Silverman and Jeff Sutton, had kind of signed off on the inevitability of the constitutionality of Obamacare. So going into the argument, most liberal commentators were exceedingly confident that the 5-4 majority would not want to upset this great and signal social achievement. And our first question out of the box from Justice Kennedy, who was thought to be always on the fence, was extremely hostile to the Solicitor General. And he says, can you create commerce in order to regulate it, saying, you've got the order upside down, sir. I mean, if there's commerce out there, you can regulate it, but you can't basically create it in order to bash it. And but really, I don't think he ever recovered his composure, because in American constitutional law, everything turns on the degree of scrutiny that you give to a particular piece of legislation. And one of the reasons why Wicked and Silber in this case, which had to do with the Agricultural Adjustment Act, was always such a devastating precedent on behalf of federal power, is that the court basically laid down and said, if you could come up with one kind of good scheme or another, any argument is fine by us, we'll give you your sway of hand. And there was not the slightest trace of that kind of deference by the five conservative Supreme Court justices.
Although later, we're going to play this clip later in the hour, but Justice Kennedy, I'm going to read the quote and later we'll air the clip, but he said, the young person who is insured is uniquely proximately very close to affecting the rates of insurance and the cost of providing medical care in a way that is not true in other industries. That's my concern in this case. So how much do you think he was reflecting there in openness to the uniqueness of the healthcare market, rejecting the slippery slope argument?
Well, that's what the point is. I think he was certainly reflecting some, but I think in the end, when he flexed a little bit further, you're going to find it very difficult to get the kind of uniqueness that he wants. There are all sorts of interdependencies that take place between people who enter and don't enter into markets, and he's going to have to ask himself very clearly why it is that you have to do this. And the reason I think that the statute is in some degree of trouble is that there were all sorts of other fixes that they could have had which did not require this extraordinary result. Let us suppose, just for the sake of argument, that universal health care is an indisputable social good. When you offer it to people, you don't have to offer it on terms that are so cockeyed that the insurance market falters. And what this bill has done is it says not only do companies have to issue the policies when you come to them, and they have no underwriting discretion as to whom to take, but if people want to quit, they can walk away, no questions asked. If you just passed the statute which said once you sign up for a company and have to stay for a full year, you would not have needed the individual mandate in order to backstop the program, and you would have been able to avoid all of these complications. So to me, the real question is going to be is how closely are they prepared to look at this jerry-built scheme to see whether or not it will survive. And as somebody who spent many, many years working on insurance schemes, the most conspicuous feature about the Obamacare statute is that it has every insurance principle exactly upside down and backwards so that this program can succeed even if you have the mandate. It's too small in terms of dollar figures to stop the bottom problem here, and the way in which they've organized the exchanges are so so heavily top-loaded with regulation that they're going to collapse because you won't be able to get companies to come in because there's no prospect of earning an ordinary profit.
That's a policy argument, which we'll do more from various points of view on another day. Today, I think we're going to stick to the constitutional
argument. I think that they do stick to the constitutional argument. The question that they constantly asked was whether this was necessary and proper. And what I've just given you is an explanation of why it was completely unnecessary. And then the argument comes, well, how could it be proper to do something which you've never done before in the history of the Republic by forcing you into the kind of transactions which you would rather not enter?
But the president's position was this wasn't the, I don't know if this is how Verrilli put it, but this isn't the only way they could have created universal health coverage. They could have just put a tax on everybody and had some kind of a fund, or they could have had a single-payer system. But this is one way to do it, a way that was politically able to get through Congress. And so the question is, does the Constitution foreclose this avenue, correct?
And the answer is yes, it does. And the reason is because they did not go through regular taxing powers, and were able to put together a coalition by having this unprecedented situation, which they could have never done if they did traditional things. The whole point of a constitution is to force the legislature to go through regularized procedure so it can take a given isolated segment of the population and put all the burden upon it. You try and draft this thing as a tax, and you have to ask yourself what the taxable event is. You can't find it. So then what you're going to have to do is to impose a tax, and that tax is going to have to be on general income or capital accounts or something of the sort, and that they cannot get through. And it's exactly the point that you want to say. You do not want to allow the Congress to be able to engage in ad hoc activities, which completely undermines the orderly process of lawmaking.
I want to play what many people are citing as a key moment from yesterday, kind of along these lines. The more conservative justices kept using examples of things besides health care that the government might require everyone to buy or to do if the court opens the door to mandatory health insurance purchases. At one point, they used cell phones as an example so that anyone could call 911. Mandatory exercise, advance funeral purchases was another because everybody eventually needs burial services. And here, Justice Scalia asks the president's lawyer, Donald Verrilli, the Solicitor General, if they can make us buy health insurance because we all use health care someday, why not broccoli? So we will hear Justice Scalia, Verrilli, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg jumping to Verrilli's aid.
Could you define the market? Everybody has to buy food sooner or later. So you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
No, it's quite different. It's quite different. The food market, while it shares that trait that everybody's in it, it is not a market in which your participation is often unpredictable and often involuntary. It is not a market in which you often don't know before you go in what you need. And it is not a market in which, if you go in seek to obtain a product or service, you will get it even if you
can't. Is that a principled basis for distinguishing this from other situations? I mean, you know, you could also say, well, the person subject to this has blue eyes. That would indeed distinguish it from other situations. Is it a principled basis? It's a basis that explains why the government is doing this. But is it a basis which shows that this is not going beyond what the system of enumerated powers allows the government to do?
Yes, for two reasons. First, this is the test, as this Court has articulated it, is Congress regulating economic activity with a substantial effect on interstate commerce? The way in which this statute satisfies the test is on the basis of the factors that I have identified.
Mr. Verrilli, I thought that your main point is that unlike food or any other market, when you make a choice not to buy insurance, even though you have every intent in the world to self-insure, to save for it, when disaster strikes, you may not have the money. And the tangible result of it is we were told there was one brief that Maryland hospital care bills 7% more because of these uncompensated costs. The families pay $1,000 more than they would that there were no uncompensated costs. I thought what was unique about this is it's not my choice whether I want to buy a product to keep me healthy, but the cost that I'm foisting on other people if I don't buy the product sooner rather than later.
That is, and that is definitely a difference.
So Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, at the end of that 2.5-minute key excerpt from yesterday's hearing, trying to bail out U.S. Solicitor General Donald Verrilli, who did not have a good day, who basically choked, according to most of the reviews. And we'll get a review of him from New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who'll be our next guest. With us currently is Professor Richard Epstein from NYU Law School and the Hoover Institution. Do you buy Scalia's broccoli analogy as meaningful for the opponent's side? Could you really argue that that's a hypothetical? You know, if they start making us buy health insurance now, then they're going to make everybody buy broccoli next. What did you make of that whole exchange?
I'm not wildly impressed with the argument, but I'm not impressed with any of the arguments in some sense. I think the key point to make here is that every time somebody engages in certain activities which increase risk, other people are going to have to bear the cost. And so what happens is if that's the principle which is behind health insurance, you can think of all sorts of other things not related to broccoli, which the government can now require you to do. And there's no question that the exercise examples start to look a little bit more prudent. That, you know, you have to make sure that you diet so that you don't get yourself so fat so you don't put additional cost on the system. There is also something else to understand about this, which is the reason why the Maryland hospital situation is in such a great difficulty is that there are other legislations out there, namely EMTALA, which require them to take in individuals who present themselves at their doorstep without insurance in any sort whatsoever and to fix them at their own expenses. And my own view about that is the same as it is here, which is if you think that there is an important social need to take care of people who do not take care of themselves, the correct way is not to do it through EMTALA, that is to force hospitals to pay for this out of their own revenues. It's to levy a general tax and to support those institutions that provide those services. And that is what could have been done in all of these cases. So to me, the central issue in this particular situation is how you keep the legislative process in order and make sure that it imposes general obligations on the public when there's a general public need or a general public perception of need in certain areas. And they just haven't done that.
They could have done it with a general tax.
They couldn't have gotten it through, and they knew that.
Right. Politically, they couldn't have gotten
and
it through.
And that's what we worry.
Isn't this like a general obligation, only it's done through the market? And wasn't it conservatives who originally came up with this idea as kind of a market-oriented approach to personal responsibility to making sure?
This is not a market solution. I mean, coercive solutions are not market. There were some people at the Heritage Foundation who were in favor of this idea. I was never one of them. So I'd rather call myself, for these purposes, a libertarian.
Yes.
And explain to you what it is that I believe, rather than having to defend what I regard in many cases as the misguided belief of others. And the central principle with this is the one of transparency, is that you don't want to allow people to shift tax burdens to those who are unable to defend themselves. And the most powerful principle for securing government regularity is to say to the majority that if you wish to impose a tax upon a minority, you must impose that equal tax upon yourself. And therefore,
but it's on everybody. Everybody must have health insurance one way or the other.
This is not that, because one of the things that really, I think, got the conservative justices quite upset is that the huge portion of the taxes that are going to be imposed on the mandate are not to make sure that the individuals will present themselves at the emergency rooms won't be free riding. 90% or 80% of the dollars that are coming out of this tax are designed to subsidize other people in the system through community health care ratings and lots of other things. So what you do is you announce to the world at large that these people are useless freeloaders, and then it turns around that you tax them 3 to 4 times the amount that they ought to pay in order to support everybody else. And it's just hypocritical to sort of emphasize one part of this particular bill when the entire rate structure is completely different. If you had decided to, as it were, to calibrate the mandate so as to make sure that people do not become free riders, it would have to be a small fraction of what would otherwise be the case. And in fact, the whole scheme is just so riddled with cross-subsidies that in the end it's going to fall down. And that's why I said at the beginning, if you understand how this whole bill is put together, you realize that the mandate is simply a desperate effort to keep together a system which ought never to have been put into place to begin with. You cannot run a stable system of insurance with massive cross subsidies. It becomes too expensive, too much moral hazard, too much adverse selection, and the whole thing will come clattering down. That's the great fear, and the mandate is just the tip of a very complicated iceberg. You get rid of the mandate, the rest of the scheme falls. Congress has to then go back and put together an insurance scheme which is a little bit more coherent from the start. So, and coherence is not a real piece of what it is that the Obama administration was trying to do.
So on that point, our next guest will be New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who was party to an amicus brief regarding today's argument on whether the rest of the law can remain in effect if the mandate is struck down. The lower court split on that. Very briefly, as your last answer, do you have an opinion either way?
Yes, I do. I mean, I actually wrote a brief on all of these things. The only things that ought to go down are Title I that deals with the private exchanges and the private market, and Part II, which deals with the Medicaid expansion. There are other things in the bill that people don't even know about, like the regulation of biosimilar drugs, and there's no reason whatsoever to touch that.
All right. You know what? We don't have Attorney General Schneiderman for another minute, so I'm going to ask you one more question.
Sure, go
and
right
it's on this slippery slope argument, which seemed to dominate the questioning of the Solicitor General yesterday on the broccoli. If they do this, it'll make us the government can make us start buying all kinds of things. Broccoli. No. Mandatory cell phones, that won't happen. Mandatory advance purchases of funerals, I mean, come on. And Scalia mentioned exercise. So give a reality check here, Professor Epstein. There's not one example there that was remotely possible. Is that the best they've got?
No, I mean, my view about all of this stuff is quite simply, you start using horribles in order to check what the scope of a power turns out to be. And if, in fact, somebody were to say that you could force anybody into a voluntary transaction of any sort, what it is a marked departure from previous practices. Look, I do not think that this is the key argument. And let me, since I have an extra minute, explain what I think is going on here. I think that the entire system of expanded commerce clause powers, based upon the position that national problems require national solutions, is a devastating error in this area. State regulation, which allows for competitive experimentation on health care, will far outperform this stuff. And Wickard and Filburn made the fatal mistake of assuming that in order to get a market to work, you have to have it nationally regulated. And what you did is you came up with the world's most grotesque cartel, which essentially really disoriented agricultural markets to this very day.
You're talking about an old 1940 Supreme Court decision.
It is the dominant Supreme Court precedent in this case, which put into place an unholy set of institutions you don't need.
About the national market in wheat, correct?
I mean, you know, and what you do is you get a cartel. And cartels are not what we want. And that's exactly what you're creating out of this. The exchanges are put together in such a fashion that everybody has to sell exactly the same kind of product, and the only thing that they can compete upon is price. If you knew anything about the operation of markets, you would see that the key element in a market is for people to experiment with different products and different kinds of combinations of goods and services so as to be able to carve out niches for themselves. That's where innovation comes from. And this bill is so stultifying. The entire premise of the modern commerce clause jurisprudence is let the federal government create massive cartels. And the entire premise of every sensible antitrust law is this is the most dangerous possible thing imaginable. The point of structural limitations on the government, and this is an issue that Justice Kennedy has always stressed, is to create liberty. And the way you create liberty is to create choices. And when you give massive federal power where it's not needed, i.e. in ordinary competitive industries, what you do is you restrict choice and you restrict liberty. And that's exactly what this bill does.
Richard Epstein, NYU law professor, fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Thank you again for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we do have New York State Attorney General with a very different, Eric Schneiderman with a very different point of view. And we'll see if he thinks that Solicitor General Verrilli blew it as much as everyone seems to think he did, coming up in a minute.